So our first question is basically just, what is Hospitality House? Like, what do you guys do?
Okay. Hospitality House sponsors refugees into Canada.
Okay.
Because Canada has a program called the Private Sponsorship of Refugees Program. And I think it is the only country that has such a program.
Okay.
Other countries resettle refugees in varying numbers through government programs. Canada has a government program too, which resettles about 7,500 refugees every year. But then they allow the private sector to sponsor refugees as well. And the numbers have been going up lately.
Mm-hmm.
They were sitting at around 3,000 a year, people a year. And now they're running, probably this year it'll be 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
The current Harper government is allowing more in than previous governments for many years. And they have set a new target for next year of 6,500 privately sponsored. So this is really good.
Right.
Many years ago when this program started, in about 1979, that was when there were boat people, the Vietnamese, Cambodians,
right,
and so on, from Southeast Asia were flooding in. Canada took over 3 or 4 years, took 60,000 at that time. There was a huge public response. And in a typical year back then, they were bringing in 20,000 a year, privately sponsored. But then it subsided as interest subsided. And now there's we're sort of at the level I've described.
Right.
Yeah.
There are about 84 groups in Canada that have a contract with the federal government allowing them to sponsor refugees under this program. And those people who have those contracts are called sponsorship agreement holders. You got this on the tape, all
right?
Yeah.
Right. And so we sponsor under the Anglican Diocese of Rupert's Land.
Okay.
Because they have a contract. And people who sponsor under a sponsorship agreement holder are called constituent groups.
Okay.
So we're a constituent group of the Anglicans.
Okay.
In Manitoba. The largest sponsor in Canada is the Manitoba Interfaith Immigration Council, which is also known as Welcome Place.
Right.
It's a settlement agency in town. So they have an agreement, and under them, they have now 84 constituent groups. So that they're the largest volume-wise in the country,
right,
not because of the number of constituent groups, because there are the United Church of Canada, for example, has one contract for all of Canada, and they've got 4,000 congregations who all could be constituent groups if they wanted to be. So that's kind of the pyramid in the way it works. But we're the second largest sponsor. We make the Anglicans of Manitoba the second largest sponsor because of our volume.
So Welcome House has a bigger volume, but you sponsor more people?
No, we sponsor after them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But we don't know. Because this year is still an open question because they moved their office. And they changed their staff.
Right.
And they've kind of got behind. So we don't know what the count will be at the end of the year, whether we'll be larger than they are or not. But we just keep plugging along, because this is one little office. funky little office. It's amazing how many people get rescued this way. Now, one of the things you need to be clear about is that You hear a lot in the newspapers and the media about refugees coming to Canada and landing on the shore and making claims and all that stuff, like the boat in British Columbia,
right,
airplanes landing in Toronto. And
right,
there's about 35,000 people in a typical year who land in Canada and say, here I am, I'm a refugee. They're called refugee claimants.
Okay.
Okay, and then their claim has to be heard. So that we, the people that we sponsor, or the government-sponsored refugees that I mentioned, it's determined overseas by the visa officers whether or not they are truly refugees. So their status as a refugee is not an issue. I mean, we do have people that we sponsor that are rejected, but it's over there.
Okay.
So that's the big difference between the people that we bring in and the people you read about mainly in the newspapers. They're refugee claimants.
Okay, so.
But the ones we bring in, although we keep calling them refugees,
right,
the truth is that when they land, when they set foot in Canada, they are then permanent residents of Canada. Okay? And in 3 years, they're entitled to apply for citizenship.
Right.
So their status is never at issue.
Okay. And so the if they got declined though from the visa office, you could still bring them over?
No.
No.
That's it.
Okay.
That's it. There's no real appeal mechanism. Where was I? I was talking about the status of people when they land,
right,
that they're now on the way to becoming Canadian citizens. Now another interesting, I know you got a bunch of questions, but another interesting fact is that although Winnipeg is about 2% of Canada's population, in private sponsoring of refugees, we account for about 50% of all the refugees being privately sponsored into Canada.
Wow.
It's huge here. It's absolutely huge. And the full impact hasn't hit yet, because like this it's been moving up gently. We get about 550 government sponsored refugees every year, which is about 8% of the number that they're bringing into Canada. That's pretty healthy for a city our size,
right?
But the number of privately sponsored coming in last year was about 700. I don't know what it'll be this year because it's too soon to say. But so the number of privately sponsored coming in is bigger by 20%, 25% than the government sponsored coming in now. It's been moving up. But the full thing hasn't happened because it's like, you know, I started pushing this and sponsoring a lot of people at the beginning of 2007. And between then, that was January 2007, and between then and the 4 years that will end this year, mm-hmm, by then I will have sponsored close to 5,000. But, so far, I haven't had more than a few hundred people arrive, okay, and most of them were sponsored years ago, not by me, but by my predecessor,
mm-hmm,
here, so that the full impact of what I've done hasn't hit Winnipeg yet, because of the time it takes to process these cases overseas, so there's a lag.
And how long is that usually?
Well, it depends on the post. I mean, Cairo will process people maybe in a year and a half. But I've got cases where people are coming in from Nairobi, which is our big post.
Okay.
It took 8 years because there's so many refugees. So the full impact hasn't hit. And the same thing is true of Welcome Place.
Right.
Because they started a lot smaller. In fact, I started the program there back in the 90s years ago, when I was at the International Center, and it was part of that operation. And it's just been building up and building up.
Right.
And so it's going to really be big, too. So we don't know what's going to happen. But to me, the interesting thing is that you may not know about Manitoba's immigration policy, but a number of years ago, the provincial government decided to get really aggressive with immigration and try to get more people into Manitoba. I mean, people automatically go to Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal. They don't even have to have, or Alberta too. They're magnets. Immigrants go there just automatically. Most of the immigrants in Canada, like three quarters or more, end up in five cities. And so we've had to sort of struggle because we have low unemployment in Manitoba. And there's a good job market here. And we need people. And the governments, the provincial governments we've had, have recognized that. And so some time ago, they announced a policy of, I think, of getting to, I think it was 12,000 immigrants a year by 2009 or something like that. Increasing every year by 1,000. They started off around 3,000 and they wanted to get up. Maybe it was 10,000 was their goal, I'm not sure. And then after they got there, they said, that this was when Gary Doer was the premier. He says, okay, now we have a new goal. We want to be at 20,000 immigrants a year by 2017. And so I don't know what we'll hit this year, but it'll probably be 13 or 14,000. So we're well on the way. And the reason why the numbers are going up is because of something called the Provincial Nominee Program, which is a program for qualifying people independently. And it's easier to get into Manitoba than it is to get into any other province in Canada. But the trick is, I'm telling you all this for a reason.
Yes.
The trick is that you can't really get in here as a provincial nominee immigrant in most cases unless you have relatives here.
Right.
Because the theory is that if you've got relatives here, you'll stick. And you won't just use Manitoba as an easy way to get to Toronto or Edmonton or Calgary or Vancouver, you see?
Right.
Well, what relevance does all this have to refugees? It's because most of the refugees that we sponsor, and all of the refugees that Welcome Place sponsors, have family already here.
Okay.
So in many ways, we're using the refugee window into Canada to provide for family reunification. Because Canada's immigration policy, except with a very narrow window that includes husband, wife, kids, and father and mother and so on, never sisters or brothers or cousins or whatnot, that family class of Canada immigration policy is very narrow, so people can't get here through that small window. So that here we have all these refugees coming in who have left family behind in the same horrible conditions that they got out of. And once they're here, they want to bring them in. They've left them in refugee camps in various parts of the world. So they're desperate to get their family here. They're probably supporting them over there from their paychecks here.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of that goes on. So we do our best to use the refugee sponsoring route as a way of achieving family reunification. Okay? And when we sponsor somebody in here, we're legally responsible for their support for 1 year. So that could be awfully expensive.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if I start bringing in $1,000 a year, which I think will happen very soon, can you imagine? You're talking like millions of dollars to support all these people, because they have to have a place to live and food and clothing and bus passes and everything else. And we can't afford that. We're just a small little agency. The way we do it is we have the family that's here sign a contract with us that says, you'll look after, we'll bring them in, we have the legal capacity to do that, but you will look after them when they get here. Okay? That's how it works. And that's why the numbers are so big in Winnipeg, because we're organized to do it. In other cities, they just haven't ever achieved that level of organization. But here, we're organized to do it, and we do it well.
Right.
Now, here's another really interesting fact about this. The reason why, I mean, see, we're still legally responsible, and other churches who do the same thing. I mean, they're all, it's the same rule for everybody. They're legally responsible. What happens if the family that signed the contract with you here welched on it?
Right.
Maybe they didn't intend to, but maybe the head of the household died.
Yeah.
And now that he's left his widow with three kids living on welfare, and she can't afford to look after a family that arrives. This is always a danger, because then it would fall back on us and we'd be stuck. So we'd have to come up with the money somehow. Aha! Here's what happened. Back in 1972, when Glenn Murray was the mayor of Winnipeg, this is something, no, people just don't know this, but when Glenn Murray was the mayor, we persuaded him to put up a fund of money from the city. The city council approved this, to put up $250,000 as a kitty that would be available if there was any of these defaults, if people failed on the sponsorship. So it was like an insurance program.
Right.
And so now, every single case, it began effective January 2003. So every single case where there's family-linked people in the thing, where the family signs a contract with us, we register that case under this insurance program. Welcome Place has the contract from the city to administer that program. So all our cases that are family linked are insured. So once you have an insurance program, then you don't worry about the father here dying, getting hit by a bus or something, you know, because you know you got a fallback position. And the interesting thing is that since that program began in 2003, there's only been about four minor claims on it, just little things. And the money has now grown to over $308,000 by simple interest,
right,
at today's lousy interest rates. So it's really wonderful.
Right.
And this is why this whole thing works so well in Manitoba. And it's all thanks to Glenn Murray when he was the mayor. So it's just an astonishing situation. Nobody else has it. Anybody else could, but it requires a government, a civic government, that would be prepared to do it. So it just works really well. And that's when we go gangbusters here, just trying to sponsor all the refugees we can. Welcome Place, the same thing. Just pushing them into the system. We also sponsor people. We sponsor people who have no family here. Those are what we call full sponsorships. That
that is to say, when they get here, we have to pay. And we have a little house over here, not far from here, that the Anglicans provide us. It's which is the hospitality house. And it's like a reception house.
Mm-hmm.
And Karen, whom you met,
right.
is the house mother.
Right. Okay.
And so that we have, like right now, we've got six young men living there who we full sponsored. And they live with us until they get a job and get on their feet and get their own apartment. So we do a few of those every year, or most years. We didn't do any this year because we have so many now in the system.
Right.
I got, actually, the beginning of this year, I had 90 refugees in the system that we'd full sponsored.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm thinking, uh-oh, what if they all came on the same plane? You know, we'd be in trouble because
exactly.
our house only holds about seven.
Right.
So we kind of hope that they'll come in some kind of logical order and we'll have enough bedrooms in the house to look after them until they move out and, you know, the system kind of works. So, but we do that too. But the sad thing is that the word is out there. I mean, there are about, let me see, 30-some million people who are of concern to the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees because they live in refugee-like circumstances. About 22 million of those are still in their own country. They've been uprooted, but they're still in their own home country. And so they're called internally displaced persons, IDPs. But then there's about 11 million who are officially designated as refugees. And that's because they have fled their own country and they're outside their country. And it's that body of people, those 11 million, that we're able to deal with through this program, this Canadian program. Well, figure it out. Canada brings in maybe 5,000 this year, and there's 11 million, you know? So the potential for people to ask us to rescue them is huge if they find out about us. We have a website. They find out about us. And the astonishing thing that has happened in the last 2-3 years is that even refugees all over the world now have email. There's cyber cafes, even in refugee camps. And they're getting email addresses, and they're writing to me. And it's unbelievable. It's absolutely unbelievable. I get emails probably at least a couple every day, maybe more, pleading with me to rescue them. It's just awful. And the stories are just unspeakable.
My mom brought a couple of them. I've actually taken a couple to school already.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And it's... So I figure that I'm turning down 1,000 people a year. And I hate to do it.
Right.
But what could I do? Bill Gates wouldn't have enough money to sponsor and all these... And even if I did sponsor them all, because Bill Gates gave me the money, Canada wouldn't let them in. Because they've got their own... Canada has its own quota on this.
Right.
And even as I say, the Harper government has doubled the number. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's doubled the number. It's still just a drop in the ocean compared to what's out there. So it's probably the hardest part of my job. I mean, when you can take a sponsorship and you can do it, that's great.
Right.
Because you're actually rescuing people. And when they land at the airport and you see them coming down the escalator, and you know you did it, I mean, it's wonderful. But what about all the people that I have to turn down? That's the hard part of the job.
And how do you choose people?
That's a really good question. Well,
like, I know in, like, for immigration, we've actually done the test of point system and, you know, how you get your points for...
That's for an independent immigrant. Or the provincial nominee program of Manitoba is a subset of the independent immigrant class. And there's points.
Right.
And you got to score 70 for Ottawa or 55 for Manitoba. And you can score yourself online, right?
Yeah.
You've probably done that.
Well, yeah, we had this little sheet and we were doing it on paper, but I think we figured out some of us wouldn't even be allowed in. But we had testimonies and we had to, you know, do that.
Well, one of the ironic things is that there've been a number of immigration ministers or people important in the government who have said, well, my father or my grandfather or whatever, they were immigrants to this country, and if they had to qualify today, they never would have got here. I'm thinking, hello, don't you understand what you're saying? This to me is a criticism of the current policy, that it's so bloody hard to get into this country. I mean, we're bringing in 250,000 or 60,000 people a year. That sounds like a lot.
Right.
It sounds like a lot. Until you remember that in 1913, when Sir Wilfrid Laurier was the Prime Minister, and he made a famous speech about the 20th century belongs to Canada. It gets quoted all the time. But what he was thinking was, he expected, because he had an active immigration policy, he expected that by the year 2000, we would have 100 million people. We ended up with 33 million. Maybe it wasn't even that in the year, maybe it was 31 or 2 million, I can't remember. But we never got anywhere near it. But in 1913, when Canada had a population of 8 million people, we brought in 400,000. Yeah, we brought in 400,000 when we only had 8 million. And now here we are at 33 or 4 million, and we're bringing in 250,000. We've never achieved the levels of 1913, ever. The First World War happened, and then the Depression happened, and then the Second World War happened, and then we got cautious. And our immigration policy ever since has been kind of maintenance, or what is called the labor market strategy. You look in the Act, it's called a labor market strategy. In other words, it's like treating people as appendages to the machines. We need a certain number of people to make commerce work.
Right.
And that's who we bring in. And we've lost the idea that we're going to build a country. That was Sir Wilfrid Laurier's plan, was to build a country and have 100 million people by the year 2000. But we've stopped building the country. All we do now is act like we're the Chamber of Commerce. That's a slight on the Chamber. I shouldn't say that, because I think there are lots of great people there. But, you know, the thinking is no longer progressive. It's just cautious, play it safe. So I think that's sad. I think we could do a lot better as a country. I'd like to make this speech all over the place.
All over the place.
All
you
over
can come
the place.
Make it for our school any day.
Because it's just, we're not seizing the opportunity. I mean, if you fly across this country on a clear day, what do you see? Space, space, space. Nobody's down there. It's empty. We got enough. I mean, we have one of the smallest population densities in the world. We're something like the same population density as Mauritius, that has mostly Sahara Desert. You know? It's just strange.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you guys don't use a point system then? You like...
Well, how do we... It's sort of... I don't know. I think sometimes I think it's I'm a very religious person, and sometimes I think it's God. Like, who do I choose? Well, before me, the sisters that ran this place. See, even though we're sponsored under the Anglicans, we were started by an order of sisters.
Okay.
And this is a Catholic institution.
Right.
And the Archbishop of Winnipeg lets us have free rent for our office space. And I'm talking with him about starting again, because we used to sponsoring under the Catholics as well as the Anglicans.
Right.
So it's very ecumenical. But so that the sisters chose people. Sister Aileen Gleason, who was really the builder of this work, she's now retired. She's a very old lady. She went to Africa for 5 years and kept referring people. She'd pick them over there. She'd actually see refugees and talk to them and say, this is a good one, and who knows why. But anyway, she'd recommended them, so we sponsored them. And there are people that she sponsored, that she recommended, that we sponsored, that are living in the house now, some of them. Then Sister Margaret followed her, and she was just picking them off the internet. You know, when people wrote her or sent her a good letter, and she was, the Spirit moved her to do it. And I've done the same thing. Like, I got this email. You can kind of judge people from the emails they send, you know? I think you can. I hope you can. And so this young fellow, I think he was about 17 at the time. He wrote me from Accra, Ghana. And he said, I'm here with my younger brother and my still younger sister. I think the brother was 15 and the sister was 14 or something like that at the time. They're orphans. They're refugees from Congo. They were living on the streets of Accra, surviving by begging. And some good church people there were helping them to survive. These three kids. And this guy wrote such a good story about, oh my God, I can't leave these three kids, three teenagers, destitute on the streets of Accra. So I sponsored them. And now a year and a half or so has gone by, so I think the oldest is about 19. You know, and the first thing that happened was I was able to get the United Nations people in Accra to take in the two younger ones, the girl and the younger girl and boy. And they had some kind of an institution there that at least they were safe. They were in a secure environment. They could go to school from there, and the United Nations looked after them. The older brother that wrote to me, he was too old to be allowed to be there because by then he was 18 and they wouldn't let him. It's gone on, and last Wednesday, not this week, but last week, they had their interview by Canada, and they passed. And so very soon, they'll be here. I hope by Christmas. It'd be wonderful if they were. It'd be really wonderful. And they're going to live in the house.
Yeah.
And Karen's going to be their mother.
So all three of them are going to live in the house?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, it'll be absolutely wonderful. But so that's the way it happens. And so I get these emails, and I've got a drawer now with about 40 or 50 cases in it of people who have completed all the right documents on our instructions that we're waiting to sponsor when I feel we have enough money. It's only the money. Strictly the money.
And how much money does it take to sponsor someone?
Well, I'd like to feel that I had about $4,000 in the bank for the first one, if it's a family, and then three for the next, three. You know, like if it was a family of three, I'd like to have $4,000 to $10,000. Because they can live with us for a while.
Yeah.
But then, hopefully they'll get a job. I mean, I'm talking now older people. With these kids I mentioned, they're going to have to go to school. That's a different case.
Right.
Yeah.
But with most of them are young men, young women, maybe a small family, father, mother, and a kid. You know they're going to get jobs. And it's great in Winnipeg because their unemployment is only 4 or 5%. So you can get jobs.
Yeah.
And maybe parking lot attendants or working at the candy factory or whatever, but it's a job. So you don't need to have enough money to support somebody for a whole year. That's what I'm trying to say.
But like the actual process, like I don't know, does the paperwork cost money and stuff
no.
like that? No?
No.
All that's
no. Now when we do the family linked cases, when the families come
right.
in here, each sponsorship we charge $100. We're allowed to do that by the federal government. That's what they allow. And we need that to run the office.
Right.
We also get donations from churches, various places. St. Mary's Academy gives us a little money every year. Holy Rosary Church gives us a lot of money. Other Catholic churches, United Churches, Presbyterian churches. We get money, you know, from donations.
And,
that keeps
and
the work going.
Do you guys do, like, fundraising type things?
We don't have time.
No.
No, we just don't have, we honestly don't have time. Because maybe we should, but we just don't. We don't get any government money. Zero.
None. Okay, that was
zero.
One of our other questions.
Any level of government. We don't get a penny. No.
Wow.
We've had a couple of small grants for specific purposes from the Winnipeg Foundation.
Okay.
They've been very good to help us, but it's small amounts of money. If we need some particular thing that can say, hey, we need a bit of money for this, you know, like new computers or something. But basically, we're self-supporting.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. It amazes me. I mean,
right.
I'm doing it, and it amazes me.
Well, it's just,
but,
like, incredible that everything costs money, so
yeah,
it's just,
yeah,
that,
yeah.
It's so hard that you're still doing so many people, and...
I know.
With being self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's, like, little stories happen all the time, and over there, in Africa, when an interview was coming up, and it could be like 4 years or 5 years since I put the paperwork in, and now they have to, so they have to contact the refugee, and the postal service in Africa
right.
can be pretty lousy. People can steal your mail.
Exactly. Or,
so sometimes they don't hear about their interview. Now in the age of the internet, we're trying to correct that by getting the visa post in Canada's office, send me an email so that I can talk to the family here. Say, the interview's coming up in 3 weeks' time. Contact your relatives in your own way. And we sort of close the
okay.
loop. And it works. Doesn't always happen. And 2 weeks ago, there's a guy that we've sponsored fully, so he doesn't have any family. And he wrote me an email, and this was from Nairobi, where the Canadian office is. And he said, I felt that my interview should be coming up, but I never had a letter, and I didn't have anything either here. He said, I went to the embassy, and they post the interviews coming up on the gate. And he says, there was my name. And not only was it my name, it was the very day that I was there. This is like, ooh, it's
okay.
weird. Very day I was there. He says, I went in, I had my interview, and I passed. So he's going to be coming here, you know. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's a weird, is that a coincidence or a miracle, you tell me, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But these kind of things keep happening all the time. What other questions have you got?
Which countries have you specifically been helping?
I'm sorry?
Which countries have you specifically been helping?
Right this past year, most of the refugees we sponsored came from two different countries, Somalia and Eritrea. They're really big right now. Years ago, it was Ethiopians. We still have a few Ethiopians. Congolese is another group. I mean, the situation in Congo is dreadful.
Yeah.
The conflict there has killed over 5 million people so far. But it's not easy to escape and become a refugee. We have about 100 cases now in Uganda. Most of those are Congolese. So then that's Africa. In the Middle East, we sponsor quite a few from Afghanistan. They tend to, most of them have fled to Pakistan. So we sponsor through Pakistan. But some of the Afghan refugees get out to Tajikistan or Russia or some other place. But we do sponsor quite a few Afghans. And that's mainly it. There was a time when we sponsored quite a few Rwandis.
Right.
But Rwanda's situation has changed. There was a time when we sponsored people from Sierra Leone and from Liberia, but the situation there has changed. And when, in the sense that now there's a stable government and some security,
okay,
so that people can go home. And as soon as that happens, as soon as the Canadian government thinks that there's stability on the ground there, then they reject the cases. And we still had, two years ago, we still had a couple of dozen Liberian cases, for example, outstanding. And I withdrew them all, having talked with the Canadian government, and found out that, in their opinion, they would be rejecting 99% of all Liberian cases. So when you have odds like that, you don't bother going forward because
right,
it's wasting everybody's
exactly
time. Yeah. So things change. Right now, the Federal Minister of Immigration has a priority on Iraqi Christians. The Americans should never have gone in there in the first place. And now we're suffering the aftermath of that. The Americans are going to pull out, and what the heck's going to happen there? And so that people are unsafe, and they're having to flee the country because it was never really resolved. So now we're going to have this huge refugee problem out of Iraq in the future, and the government sees this coming. And the minister met with the Conference of Catholic Bishops a couple of years ago. And at the time, I don't know if he still is, but Archbishop Weisgerber from Winnipeg was the head of the conference. And they had this meeting in Toronto, and there was a lot of pressure put on the government by the bishops and also by the Iraqi community in Toronto to try to rescue these people. And so that's why I'm suggesting it.
Right.
Yeah.
There was another movement. They weren't Christians, but there were Iraqi, were they? Palestinians. Palestinian Iraqis in a little camp called Al-Hol in Syria. And the Canadian government and some agencies, like I think the Mennonites, felt that they needed to rescue these people because they were like, they couldn't go back. They were people nobody wanted. They were citizens of Iraq, but they were Palestinians of ethnic origin. So a bunch of us agreed to try to sponsor them. And we've got a family here now we brought in of Iraqi Palestinians, but they're Muslims. Okay, so we're almost finished our support of them. This is our last month to have. November is our last month to have to support them. And some others came in too. The Mennonites brought in two families, and we brought in one. So it does happen, and you see, what we know will happen now is the way this thing works is that I figure you're bringing in one refugee, and that one refugee will produce a request for three, and then the three will go to nine, the nine will go to 27, the 27 will go to 81, and that's the way it goes.
Right.
And that's why we're so busy. In simple terms, that's why we're so busy.
And so like, if you're sponsoring, you said that you only sponsor like full sponsorships every once in a while, but even if they have a family base, are you still sponsoring full families or just like individuals?
You have to do the whole family.
Okay.
It used to be many years ago, back in the days when they were building the West, some father from Ukraine, let's say, would come in, get a job, get started, and then he'd send for the family.
Right.
And that does make a lot of sense. A lot of sense. Why can't you just sort of bring in the head of the household and let him get established, get a job, and so forth? But currently, the Canadian government will not allow you to do that. If you decide you want to sponsor a family, you have to sponsor the whole family. Because if they're all together in the same refugee camp, and you take, like Somalis tend to have huge families, it's nothing to have a family of 10. You know, father, mother, and 8 kids. So you got to do the whole thing. I mean, oh my gosh. But the families here are doing it. They're making those sacrifices. But sometimes it's only the father that got out, and he's in the camp, and the other 9 members are still back home in Somalia. They couldn't get out. When you sponsor, you know that only the father's going to come in first, but you have to sponsor the 10. You put all the names down on the papers, and this is very important. And then so father gets here, and then the government has what they call a 1-year window, and he has 1 year from the time that he arrives to ask for his family to be brought in. And that's the way it works, and that works very well, because by then he's established.
Mm-hmm.
But if they're all together, they've all got to come.
And I don't think it was a refugee, but my dad, he sponsored someone to come work for him as a plumber.
Mm-hmm.
And he was from Colombia.
Yeah.
So, and then he was staying with us for a little while, but he was, he was here, and he was like, you know, trying to get his money in his place and stuff.
It was probably a temporary foreign worker program.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, like, for people that don't know what exactly is the difference between refugees and immigrants.
Yeah, there's a big difference.
Right.
An ordinary immigrant qualifies to come in here because on the basis of their skill sets,
right.
Their education, their command of English or French. I mean, they tend to be highly qualified people to come in. So you end up with a situation where somebody with a PhD is driving a taxi cab in Edmonton. That's not uncommon.
I know.
And I know that 2 or 3 years ago, I looked at the situation in Alberta. They were getting these people with all these qualifications, and they had 30,000 job vacancies in the food services industry in Alberta. Can you imagine? 30,000. I was in Red Deer to make a speech, and as we drove in, someone was driving, we drove in, there was this, you know, this big highway that went between Calgary and Edmonton, and double, you know, there was space in the middle, and there's a great big interchange and all the rest of it, and there was a closed Tim Hortons in the middle of this interchange, you know, and my driver, the guy that was driving, says, you see that? He says, do you know why that place is closed? They can't get anybody to work there. Tim Hortons. Closed. that was a bit, I don't think they have that problem today in Alberta, because there's been a slump in the oil industry.
Right.
But it's those kind of jobs that are basically needed. Like, if you have had anybody in the hospital, and you've had occasion to go to the hospital, what do you see? Who are all the people cleaning the floors, acting as, you know, assistants to the nurses? What do you call those people? Healthcare aides or something. They're all like Filipinos or Africans, because that's what the jobs are. They're where the jobs are, and they're needed. You know, so I feel that we've kind of. And a lot of people, it's not just me, but a lot of people recognize now that we've been focusing too much on high qualifications.
Right.
I was on a committee with the engineering faculty at the University of Manitoba, and it was a national committee looking at the plight of engineers. And one of the people we had on our committee was the registrar of engineers for the province of Ontario. And he at the time, he said, this was just a couple of years ago, he said, I've got 8,000 engineers who are fully qualified, who are registered with the Professional Association in Ontario, who do not have jobs in engineering. 8,000. This was right after the big meltdown of IT. You know, and there just wasn't, everybody wants to, like, nowadays I keep talking to people, what do you want to do, what do you want to do? Oh, I think I'll go to Red River and take a job in, take a course in computer technology. I'm thinking, dear God, everybody loves computers. I love computers. You love computers. Everybody loves computers, so everybody wants to have a job as a computer tech. You think there's enough, you know, enough jobs? I'm not sure there are.
Right.
I think it's going to be like when I was young. God, that was a long time ago. It was the typewriter.
Right.
Yeah.
It was very sexist in those days. And all girls wanted to learn to type.
Right.
And all girls were going to be secretaries. This was the big thing for girls. Going to be a secretary. Yeah. What happened? Computers were invented. And now lawyers, for example, do their own typing. They don't need a secretary. Maybe you need one secretary for six lawyers. Whereas back then, each lawyer needed two secretaries for himself.
Yeah.
I was one, so I know. I mean, that's what happens, technology.
Right.
And you fall in love with the technology of the moment. And that's what engineering, what happened to engineers. And then Nortel collapsed.
Right.
Yeah.
And do you think that, like, qualified immigrants, ever since, like, refugees taking up, like, you know, middle management jobs, you know, kind of the lower end of the scale and stuff, even those that are qualified to do something more than that, like, do you think that kind of increases the wealth divide between, you know, people that are already, like...
Well, that's a very good question. I would make a generalization about this, that people who immigrate as adults to this country may never achieve the level of success, whether you're dealing in terms of economic success, that they would have achieved had they been able to stay home in a safe, secure, prosperous environment. But they make a sacrifice to come here for the safety of themselves and their families and to give their kids a chance. This happens over and over again. It's been happening for 200 years in this country. And we study this. We have university professors who study the way, how well are refugees doing these days. And, well, they're not doing as well as this other, they used to or whatever, because there's this gap they're talking about. And I have a problem with this. The basic problem I have is that we tend to value people in this society on the basis of how much money they make.
Right.
Yeah. And yet, in the complexity of our economy, everybody's important. I mean, we have to have people behind the counter at Tim Hortons. We have to have people in the on the assembly line in the candy factory. We have to have people at the top. And I think there's something perverse about saying that you're not, because you're not doing so well, you're not contributing to society. I don't think that's right. You need all these people, but it's kind of a capitalistic mentality,
right.
And I don't think it's just wrong. Everybody has value in our society. You know, even people who don't have a job have value because they're consumers. They create part of the demand,
right,
that give other people jobs. You know, I think it's too simplistic to just start measuring people like, how much money do you make?
Right.
I said at one point, they were talking about this, I said, I have a very simple solution. If you want to increase the average income in this country, I can do it overnight, just overnight. Kill everybody below the median level of income. You know, you're crazy. Well, you're crazy too.
Yeah. Well, and we've just been focusing a lot, like, Brad and I, we were trying to learn on different countries about how we could improve Canada in means of the wealth divide. Like, I did Norway and Brad did Sweden. Yeah, both very prosperous and, you know, countries that really know what they're doing kind of thing. And we were talking about how in the, you know, 50s and 60s in the States, how everyone was taxed at 90%. And that's how they, accomplished so many things.
Yeah.
And so, if there should be a redistribution of wealth, thank you, that, like, by means of taxation or capping people off, but I'm not sure whether people who do the more simplistic jobs, seemingly, like people that come in from different countries, whether they should be awarded or paid more, because it's just that it seems that once you get into those kinds of things that you can't get out, and that they can't ever move up the chain.
Well, you've introduced a whole bunch of topics here, like the tax system.
Right.
I was reading a review of a book in the Free Press. You know, they do those book reviews on the weekend.
Yeah.
This was not this last weekend, but the one before. Now, I've forgotten the name of the book. I thought, my gosh, I must get that book. But it was a new book out by some woman, professor somewhere in Canada, about this very question of the way the tax system has changed in the last few years. Whereas there used to be a progressive tax system. It's now switched,
right.
and so that you're getting people who are getting really, really rich, really rich. I mean, so much money, it sounds indecent to me.
Exactly.
And there are other people who are still struggling, as they all have always struggled. And so she was suggesting that we need to look again at the tax system. So I've forgotten the name of the book or the name of the author. How am I going to find that one? Because I wanted to get it. But anyway, there is a book out. And it was 2 weeks ago in the Free Press. You could look for that.
Okay.
It'll give you a lot of valuable information on that.
Yeah, because I just watched the film The Social Network, who's about the guy who created Facebook, and at the end of the movie they gave all the stats and stuff, and even, like, he was being sued by two people, one who claimed they stole the idea from him, and another was his partner that he had sort of cut off, and they said, like, they'd each sued him and won, like, $65 million in settlements, both of them between them, and he was still able to become the youngest billionaire in the world. And
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. it just drives me crazy. And then you see how much an NBA player makes, or a hockey player. I'm thinking, this is indecent. It's not fair. I mean, people are struggling to raise families while people get super rich. And you can't take it with you.
No.
So, what's the point?
And that's what we were kind of talking about, whether, you know, you get to a point where you're just not allowed to have any more money. Like, there's just that you have, there's no amount of planes or anything that you can do anymore.
I know.
You can ever just devalue yourself.
What do you do with the money? I mean, you can't eat any better.
Yeah.
I mean, people in Canada, even if you don't have much money, you can eat pretty well.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that when you get old, you eat a hell of a lot less. And you can't even stand rich food the same way you do when you're young. So it becomes pointless to, I mean, if I had $1 trillion, I wouldn't be able to spend it on food, and everybody can only sleep in one bed. How good can your bed be?
Yeah.
You know. I'd love one.
What do you like?
Just milk.
Just milk?
Yeah. What do you do with it? Leave it to your children and destroy them.
Mm-hmm.
Most people who inherit a lot of money become useless.
Right.
Yeah.
You were telling me about Bill Gates' son, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it wasn't, but I think it was like Ryan Fair, but they were talking about how Bill Gates' son, Bill Gates isn't leaving any of his money to his family because he doesn't want them to become spoiled or become useless. Like
yeah.
he said, he wants them to earn a living and earn their own wealth.
Yeah, but he's exceptional.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots and lots and lots of millionaires in the middle that are making their kids millionaires.
Yeah, he's starting a foundation, though, to make other billionaires.
I know that. He's trying to get people to give away half their money.
Right.
Yeah, he's got a few people that have signed up for it, like Warren, whatever his name is, the rich American. But
we could even get Hartley Richardson to sign up for it.
Who knows?
Let's try.
Wonder how much money he really has. They're supposed to be
billions. He's worth more than Oprah.
Okay.
He's got lots of money.
Yeah.
I think he was in the paper the other day. His net worth is $16 billion or something.
Yeah. I know, and then every organization that needs money, like the ballet or the symphony or whatever.
Exactly.
They all kiss butt just like you wouldn't believe in order to get some of it. Thank you very
You're
much.
You're welcome.
Yeah.
You two are on the
You can get some too, she's really saying, yeah.
No, she's saying that she's not getting it for us.
That's right.
Different.
Exactly, yes.
Yes. If there was a specific message that you had to tell people about refugees and sponsorship programs and stuff like that, like, what would you say?
Well, I would encourage them to get involved
right.
in the private sponsorship program. It's a unique opportunity in Canada. I would encourage them to approach the government to open the doors a little wider and let more in. But then recognizing that this government has done more than any previous government. And the Harper government gets lots of flack for being reactionary. In this area, they have been anything but. They've been really good.
I don't think enough people know that.
People don't know that. Because what's the focus today? It's on this new Bill C-49 that was announced a couple of days ago. And believe me, if you're in the right section on the internet, like I am, you'll find people are going crazy over this. They're so upset because they're trying to close the doors because that boat landed with those people. If you come in on a boat, boy, oh boy, you're in trouble. Thousands come into Toronto Airport on airplanes every year and make claims, and nobody blinks about that one. But come in on a boat, and my God. So then I got stuck. And you see, that's another message I would talk about is that we're talking about, we've got to stop these human smugglers.
Right.
Well, what are they doing? they're mainly punishing the refugees.
Yeah.
That's who's the victims, who are desperate to get here and who paid somebody to get them here, the smuggler. They wouldn't have got here any other way. That was their choice, their option to get out of wherever they were as desperate people. So, I mean, there, a lot of people could get caught in that trap of you help somebody to get into the country, you're breaking the law if you're using some clandestine way of doing it, and you may be saving a life. So these are the whole question of the sanctity of national borders. It's a big moral question. One of the things I've been writing stuff about is ethics and migration. And where do you draw, how, I mean, countries are allowed to maintain their own borders, to be in charge of their own landmass, keep people out. Are there ethical issues around that? I mean, the idea of borders in terms of human history, it's got to be relatively modern. And a lot of them are very artificial. I mean, the borders in Africa were largely created because of the colonial picture imposed on the country by, you know, the colonial powers, Britain and France and Portugal and Germany and, you know, Italy. They created the borders. So we end up with countries with all kinds of mixtures of people in them. I mean, Sudan is a good example, between the north and the south. The north is Arab and Muslim, and the south is Christian, animist, black Africans. And they're all lumped together because that's the way it was in British colonial times. And it makes no sense. When I was in Uganda, I discovered that the national broadcasting system broadcast in 16 different languages. Here in Canada, we think it's remarkable because we have two.
We're going to nerd when they announce it in French first.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, the whole business of borders is very artificial.
Right.
And yet they become sacrosanct. You can't move across them without permission. But then we decide it's like after the First World War, then they change a whole bunch of borders. And now they're all different. And Poland is this side of the line instead of that side of the line. And, you know, so that's a good example of a country that's at various borders throughout its history. So these are big ethical issues. We don't talk about them. And I think there's been, in my view, a failure on the part of the churches to speak out on ethical issues. And they're, and of course, religion is in decline in society generally now.
I had this discussion the other day too.
It used to be the big thing, and they had, and you, when the churches spoke, you listened. Now the churches speak, and nobody pays any attention. And it used to be that you could teach religion in the school system, let's say, and some maybe now you can't, or you could have. You could have the Lord's Prayer, and now you can't, and all that sort of thing. So there is a reaction to that, which is very interesting. And one of it's the teaching of ethics. And I don't know if that's a topic that comes up in the high school curriculum or not, but it's at Red River now. A lot of ethics is being taught to students at Red River. My son is one of the people that teaches it. It's like a replacement for religion.
Right.
Why? It makes sense. Because you used to get moral and ethical values out of the teachings you absorbed in church. Okay? Now you don't go to church.
Exactly.
So where do you get it?
Right.
So they're teaching ethics. Simple as that.
Well, and I think ethics is like a good idea in the sense that obviously one of the biggest divides in the world are all due to, you know, other than race, is religion.
Yeah.
And because people can't decide that upon, like, a religion, ethics is kind of like, you know, lonely sister, but and it makes more sense and everybody...
That's a good phrase. I want to remember that. Ethics is the lonely sister of religion.
Well,
is that original with you?
Yes.
That's good.
But just that people, like, everybody can disagree upon decency and, you know, good morals and you know, how people should behave. And so, like, that's not really an argument. And if you bring in the more specific things about it, that's what gets people upset. So you can teach people to be good people without, it, like, posing religion upon them.
Yeah. So, but then you ask the question, coming back to immigration, okay, how does this good, decent person react to somebody that arrives on the shores in a leaky boat and says, here I am, I'm a refugee? Get out? Or what? What do you do?
Well, and that was, they were having a big debate about that on, like, BBC when, I was actually in Europe when the boat came in and was in Canada, and they were talking about, like, you know, do you tell them to hit the road and go home, or do you let them in? And, like...
And you see, it's very different. it's very different in Europe, between Europe and Canada, and the way we approach all these things. Because in Europe, if you're in Denmark, you're a Dane. You're Danish, you're white, you're a Dane. That's it. And so now they have a few of these people that are not Danes and they're not white. And they're really very discriminatory against them. I've been in many European countries and I've observed this firsthand. Like Sweden, for example, has quite a few people now who are apparently, you look at them and you're going through a crowd and you see people, they have sort of a Middle Eastern look.
Right.
You don't see many Africans, but you see Middle Eastern looking people. There's a tension in all of this because they may be not Swedes and they don't like them being there and so on. But the birth rate in all Western European countries is so low that in 100 years they won't exist. That's right.
Get out.
That's right. That's right. Because the birth rate has subsided, like it's the lowest in Italy.
Right.
Even with the Catholic Church being against the pill and all the rest of it, apparently. It's the birth rate in Italy is the lowest in Europe. It's 1.1 live births per female. A population has to have a birth rate of 2.1 to survive. Per female, 2.1 per female. The low countries like the Netherlands and Belgium, they're at about 1.2. But all across Europe, they're in that kind of a range. Not in Eastern Europe yet, but the more prosperous an area gets,
right,
the more the birth rate falls. And it's falling fairly fast. Like, about 1997, our birth rate was around 1.7 in Canada. It's now at 1.5. So Canada, if we didn't take in any immigrants, we would look forward to extinction also. We keep watching our cities get bigger. lot of that sort of internal migration. We watch them get bigger and bigger and bigger, and we think everything is growing. But what Canadians don't realize is that 45% of the urban centers in Canada right now are losing population. 45% are losing population. You go to towns in Nova Scotia, for example, and every census, they're smaller than the census before.
Right.
I'm familiar with that because I come from there. I mean, places that used to have a hospital no longer have a hospital. Places that used to have a high school no longer have a high school. They no longer have a doctor. And we don't see that because we live in a city that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But there's a lot of country, Canada, that's going in the opposite direction. We're projected now on the basis of our current birth rate and our current immigration rate to continue to grow as a country to about 42 million people. But at that point, if we don't change, have more babies or have more immigrants, we will begin to decline. And you see, what happens is the decline is very fast because people die.
Right.
There's a certain lifespan. You've got, 70, 80 years of life and you're dead. And so, that's the typical, what is it now? It's about 80, 79 for a man, 81 for a woman in Canada. And you're dead. So as the population ages, all of a sudden, they're all going to be buried or cremated or put into an exhibition like the one downtown.
Body museum.
So, that's what happens.
Yeah.
And people don't see that because they just live for now. I'm okay. I'm living for now. They don't realize. We raised 5 kids. I have 2 children. I have 2 of them have children. Just 2. And they each have 2 kids. So we went from a family with 5 kids to 4 grandchildren. This is nowhere near a replacement. You see? Because when you get married, that one becomes 2. You see, it isn't working.
Well, and I guess places with, developed countries versus non-developed countries. Developed countries are always more, money and financially driven. So mothers believe that they can't be a homemaker and be a professional at the same time. So, and I think that's, and it kind of ties in with, the decline of the church.
Sure.
Because,
everybody's too busy.
Too busy to go to church. And the biggest thing is that they don't need hope anymore. The people that go to church are people that need hope.
Yeah.
And that's why I was talking to Father Jerry, and he was saying, where the church is right now is flourishing is in, South America,
yeah,
in the Asian countries, and in Africa, places that aren't, stable.
That's right.
Because those people need hope and they need faith. And because we're already on the rise, we don't need those things anymore. We don't need tons of children to, make our lives, fulfilled because we have our work.
Or just to make sure that there's somebody to carry on,
right,
for us.
Yes, that's right.
And so, it all kind of ties in then.
You buy your hope now.
Exactly. And I just don't think that people realize, and, between the church, the birth rate and, immigration, people don't realize how important, our refugees are in our society.
No, we're generously bringing them in, but we really need them.
Yeah, they do as much for us as we do for
them.
That's
right. And one of the issues that I think it will eventually get resolved. But do you realize that every government-sponsored refugee and every privately-sponsored refugee arrives in Canada at the cost of an airline ticket and also the small cost of a medical examination overseas, which usually about $100, $150, plus a ticket from Nairobi, which may be $1,000, $1,200. They have to pay that back. It's a loan. So we're judging the economic success of a refugee here and writing papers about it. And we don't allow for the fact that if it was a family of 10 that arrived, Somalis, one father working and a mother with 8 kids, they probably have the travel and medical loan of close to $20,000. Now they have to pay it back. So that's how they start life in Canada with that.
And no one ever sees
it. And nobody sees it.
No.
And you know they have the highest repayment rate of any kind of government loan in this country. They honor that and they pay it back. Now this current minister that everybody's on the back of for something all the time, he wants to get rid of it. And he told me, he says, you know, he said, I would have got rid of it this year. But he said, they'd laugh me out of the cabinet room if I tried to do it, because this is the year when the government is losing $50 billion. He says, this is the wrong time to suggest it. But he really wants to get rid of it. There it is, it's still there.
Yeah.
And like, now we're bringing in these 3 teenagers that I told you about. It'll probably cost $4,000 to get them here with their medical costs. The medical costs are $480, plus the 3 airline tickets. Let's say it's $4,000. They're not even going to be going to work. We're going to have to find the money for that. Pay it back. Probably go to some churches and ask them to raise the money. You know, but so we're very generous as a country to a point.
You know? To a point,
yeah.
Yeah, we've got you here, folks. Now there's a bill, and because I'm a mail drop for a lot of these people, I see the Dunning letters. After 3 months here, they start getting a Dunning letter from Ottawa.
You owe this much?
You owe this much. 3 months after they get here.
And if they don't speak English, then jobs are complicated.
Yeah, that's right. You sure, when you get on the inside of all this, you sure see a lot.
Right.
But I see the wonderful part of it too, and I have a fellow who's, he'd be in his 50s now, I guess. He's an Ethiopian. And he has just an ordinary job. I think he operates a forklift somewhere. And he's always worked really hard. He's brought in all kinds of people. He's really as the guarantor of our sponsorships. But his own kids, he's got them in professional faculties at the University of Manitoba. They're going to be lawyers and doctors.
No, one of my other questions for you is
happens all the time.
Going
all the time. There's such a huge emphasis on education on the part of these immigrant families. They're really doing well. The next generation. But you know, we never measure the next generation. See, I've been part of this thing called the Metropolis Project since it began 15 years ago. It's all universities in Canada, and there's research centers across Canada and so on. And the professors do research projects around their PhD students and their MA students and stuff. Lots of research. And there's Statistics Canada data sets you can access about all sorts of stuff. And like every immigrant that's arrived in Canada since 1970 is in the computer. And they match their income level to their year of arrival. So it can, and their income tax returns. It's all in the computer since 1970. So wonderful data. The problem is, you can't do the next generation. Because you don't know what the kids. So there's no way of going to the computer and the records and identifying the second generation and seeing how they're doing. The only way you could do that is by actually picking out the people and going and interviewing them. There's never enough money to do that. sure fascinating. Because I think that if you could get to that next generation, you'd really be astonished at what's happening.
Well, and the question is more so, like, a lot of people strongly believe that, like, first-generation immigrants can never be fully integrated into their new country. Like, would you agree with that?
I think that's self-evident. Yeah, I think that's right. How could you possibly be? Unless you're a kid when you come.
Right.
I mean, if you, as long as you come as a 10-year-old or younger, or even 15 or 16 and younger, you're going to integrate. You're going to be a Canadian kid. I see it all the time. But when you get older, it's harder. I don't see this as a bad thing. Again, it goes back to what, whether we value people on the basis of how much money they make or not.
Right.
Yeah. Or the impact on future generations and the contribution to the building of the nation over the years to come. I mean, there's lots of... So how many generations has your family been here?
I believe I'm fifth generation Icelandic.
How about you?
Yeah, I'd probably be around that too, like fifth or sixth from like Scotland and France.
I'm 15. My kids are 15. On the European side, but I'm actually part. I'm the last generation of my family entitled to a treaty card, so I'm Aboriginal.
Oh.
Yeah. Not from around here, from New Brunswick.
Yeah.
So you can't really tell about people, can you?
Yeah, but I think that just in general, Canadians are, and like, but then again, should be more welcoming to diversity and things like you're telling us about, you know.
We should be more, but we're not bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, we're
not
awful. Back in the year 2000, we had a big conference here put on by the Business Council of Manitoba, that group in Alberta, the Canada West Foundation, and somebody else, I forget. Big conference. And in preparation for the conference, they commissioned some polling group to do a study of the 10 provinces of Canada and the 48 continental states of the United States. And they had money to do this. So, and to do a survey on tolerance. And they found that of the 58 jurisdictions they studied, that the two most tolerant places in North America were Manitoba and Saskatchewan. And that actually didn't surprise me.
No.
Because I often say to people, well, there's no majorities here.
Totally.
There's no majorities.
No.
Everybody's a mixture. And that's why I think Winnipeg in particular, I think that I'm not so sure about the rural areas, but Winnipeg in particular, this is a very tolerant city. Tends not to matter who you are, where you're from. And that's one of the things I like about the place.
Yeah. Sure, not the weather. Not cold anyways.
Well, hey, I think we have better weather than they do in Alberta or Saskatchewan. We get that little funny peak that every once in a while we get the weather from the south. Look at what this fall has been like.
Fall's been beautiful.
It's been gorgeous.
Not looking forward to snow.
No. Yeah. What else have you got there?
I don't know. I think we actually...
You got an
and
obstacle.
I've diverted.
Yeah. Talked about everything.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Now you can turn it off.
Oh, yes.